2017 marked a revolution in cancer treatment. The FDA approved the first CAR T-cell therapy. This groundbreaking approach teaches a patient's own immune cells to fight their disease. Behind this scientific breakthrough stands Dr. Carl June, director of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. His pioneering work as part of the PiCy network has fundamentally changed how we think about treating and curing cancer, earning him science's highest honors, including the 2024 Breakthrough Prize in Life Sciences and the 2024 Warren Alpert Foundation Prize. I'm Dr. Shane Corcoran from PiCy. Today, on From Bench to Fireside, our Chief Scientific Officer, Dr. John Connolly, sits down with Dr. June to explore what's next in cellular therapy. They dive into cutting-edge advances like CRISPR gene editing and new ways to deliver CAR T-cells directly into patients. You'll hear how PiCy facilitated collaboration among the world's top cancer research centers is speeding up progress, from lab discovery to patient impact. Plus, Dr. June shares his vision for training tomorrow's pioneers in immunotherapy. Take a front row seat to the future of cancer treatment as we go from bench to fireside.
I'm John Connolly, Chief Scientific Officer of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. Today I'm joined with Dr. Carl June, the Richard W. Vogt Professor of Immunotherapy in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine. He's also Director of the PiCy Center at the University of Pennsylvania and Director for the Center for Immunotherapies at the Perelman School of Medicine. Carl is someone who needs no introduction. His work has led to the first FDA approval for CAR T therapy in 2017 for children and young adults with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and truly pioneered the field of CAR T therapy, such a critical aspect of cancer immunotherapy in the space. So we're incredibly grateful to have you as part of the PiCy network, Carl, and to have you here today. It's a welcome. It's an honor to speak to you, and thanks for joining From Bench to Fireside.
Well, John, thanks. It's been a pleasure and an honor to work with you and the PiCy team over the last 7 or 8 years now. And it's wonderful to be in this era of evolving immunotherapies for cancer.
Absolutely. So you have been part of the PiCy network from the very beginning. Can you tell me a little bit more about how you first got involved with PiCy and what the needs PiCy filled at that time?
Yeah, it's been a wonderful event. I mean, we've had over the years, you know, for earlier kinds of cancer therapy, really pharma, you know, footed most of the bill on research and clinical testing. But with personalized therapies, with cell therapies, that just wasn't happening. And so I was fortunate to meet, as you know, Sean Parker early on in the evolution of this, to ask whether he could get all this, you know, major cancer centers together in the same sandbox, you know, to team up and accelerate rather than us all working in a parallel fashion. And so, you know, I think it officially began in 2015, and it's been amazing. I mean, we've had multiple findings that I am quite sure would not have happened if we had all worked in parallel. So by joining these groups together to, you know, promote both bench and basic research and in clinical trials, it's been, I think, game-changing for the field.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of that network effect of linking up the fundamental researchers with the translational researchers and the clinician scientists to really push this forward. I've seen it in action. It's really been amazing. And you've been at the forefront of this, Carl. So can you tell me a little bit more about your current work? What are the main research areas that you have going right now that most excite you?
It's been really exciting. We have, as you know, with PiCy, the network co-funded the first trial ever in humans with CRISPR, and we did multiplex editing and found both safety and highly efficient on-target editing in that trial. But we also found some limitations, for instance, you know, some chromosomal translocations. So we're now working, you know, with both investigators at Stanford and San Francisco to take this to the next level. I think that the field that with solid tumors, which is our primary effort, that this issue of cell exhaustion and dysfunction is a major issue. Another one has been, you know, we don't have dream targets like we did in blood cancer for BCMA and CD19. And so solid tumors don't have dream targets, and the targeted, in addition to this exhaustion and trafficking into solid tumors, is the main focus.
Sure. And so, you know, in blood cancer, of course, you have that kind of clonality that, or semi-clonality that develops, where you have something like CD19 target or a BCMA or something like that. But is there, do you think we'd be able to keep up? I mean, this heterogeneity in the solid tumor space where you need to target multiple antigens, or even there's a dynamic nature of the changes in cancer under selective pressure. Do you think that we'll be able to keep up and create multi-CAR? Is that an approach, or is it just something that we just can never get ahead of?
I mean, none of us foresaw what would happen, I think, with lipid nanoparticle technology, you know, the main gift of COVID. And you know, Avery Pose in our group has been working actively in making, you know, CAR pools where we could use, you know, RNA as a pool to make multiple CARs that are transient and expressed. And that's a very efficient technology, and it can be done both with ex vivo manufacturing or in vivo delivery, I think. And we didn't know where that would actually first start. But then this year, you know, with our Parker collaborators at City of Hope, we've seen huge advances in glioblastoma, and also with Marcella Maus now at Mass General. So I think maybe the first place that will be tested, you know, will be in glioblastoma, where we know there are subclonal variants, and this will be a fertile testing ground.
Absolutely. This is such a tough cancer, and any progress in that space is just, it's going to be revolutionary. So one other area, and I think in glioblastoma, this might be particularly important, that you mentioned was this tumor microenvironment. This is something that's, you know, in solid tumors is always a challenge. What are the things that you're seeing now that are coming out, either from a synthetic biology standpoint or just from a raw immunology standpoint, that are addressing these big challenges and mechanisms of resistance in the solid tumor space?
I think we found that one thing, that effector to target ratio matters. So, I mean, if you don't get your soldiers to the tumor, it's a problem. And as I just mentioned, like in glioblastoma, you know, we did two previous trials here at the University of Pennsylvania with CARs given by intravenous administration, and really had no clinical benefits. And then now, by switching to intracranial administration, you know, both at City of Hope, at Stanford, at Mass General, and here at the University of Pennsylvania, we're seeing much higher effector to target ratio in the tumors and clinical benefit. So, you know, but when we go below the neck into pancreatic cancer, the story is not so nice. There we've done infusions now directly into metastatic lesions of CAR T cells in pancreatic cancer, and we're getting very little infiltration into the tumors. They stay cold. Mm-hmm. So trafficking and penetration of the stroma. And then I think there's the, you know, clearly the exhaustion and dysfunction that occurs are huge issues, you know, still to be solved.
Sure. And how do you see the kind of, you mentioned CRISPR, but the advent of both CRISPR-I and CRISPR-A and in modulating that gene expression, how do you see that impacting things like the exhaustion and persistence of these cells?
You know, I think, you know, clearly in mouse models, there are many targets now that by modulating either through CRISPR-A or CRISPR-I, we can make a difference. And as you know, PiSE has led a consortium with Friends of Cancer Research and the FDA so that we can actually begin to screen in humans through many. There's the problem really facing this. There's over 100 targets.
Yeah.
That look really promising. But if we do those one by one, or even two by two screens, you know, we're never going to find what might be optimal. So I'm optimistic that we can eventually be able to do screens in humans. I think we've also learned from comparison of results in glioblastoma, for instance, pancreatic cancer and prostate cancer, that the tumor microenvironment actually shapes them differently. I mean, there's not going to be, I don't think, at least one magic bullet of an ideal T cell. I think it's going to have to be, matched to what the tumor biopsy shows is, is the Achilles heel of that given tumor microenvironment.
Yeah, that makes a huge amount of sense. And how do you see the, we put these engineered cell therapies in there, you talked about effector target ratio and the ability to recognize the tumor, that killing event that happens, and the ability to persist. There's also a second arm to this immune response, which is, myeloid cell component, the recruitment of NK cells, gamma delta T cells, sort of the natural immune response as a T cell would do it. How do you see that that arm, the sort of second order immunological response, really leading to durable anti-tumor immunity?
Yeah. So as you know, I mean, with checkpoint therapy, probably a major part of that is all in studies of, John Weir at our institute, Jed Wolchuk and so on, has shown that after checkpoint therapy, a major issue is the recruitment of endogenous T cells. And then probably natural killer cells and then reprogramming of those immunosuppressive myeloid cells. So that has to happen, I think. Unfortunately, the details for each tumor probably aren't exactly the same. We have an ongoing trial that, in refractory lymphomas where if we armor CAR T cells with IL-18, we're finding much better responses than the same CAR without the IL-18. And some of this early spatial biology analysis that Andrew Reck has done at our institution shows a major increase in NK cell and sort of type 1-like macrophages into the tumor microenvironment. So I think reprogramming the tumor microenvironment is going to be possible with, say, an engineered T cell or an engineered NK cell, and then maybe in combination with other agents like bispecific engagers or oncolytic viruses.
Carl, what do you think? I mean, it seems when you're framing it that way, where you're engineering in sort of the key communication nodes like cytokines and chemokines to recruit different immune cells, that you're sort of engineering back toward a sort of system-wide immune response. From the vaccine side, I guess the sort of another direction where you're immediately engaging the entire immune response or even checkpoint, it seems like people are starting to engineer these vaccines even more using synthetic biology engineer, that both sides are kind of starting with synthetic biology or starting with natural immunity, kind of converging on this kind of synthesis of the two approaches. Do you see that there's a role in vaccine combinations with CAR T therapy that's out there? I know that BioNTech had a Claudin-6 CAR T and combination self-amplifying RNA approach. Do you think that this is an approach that others may be pursuing?
Since we have, as we briefly discussed, this ongoing issue of once a T cell gets into the tumor microenvironment of a solid tumor, they rapidly become dysfunctional. So one way to get around that is having a peripheral compartment, where there's boosting and antigen presentation in a way that can restore or at least cause persistence of functional T cells. So I think we'll see many ways to do that. I mean, one, as you said, can be this vaccination. And as you know, the approach with BioNTech and at Memorial Sloan Kettering that Balachandran's group has done in pancreatic cancer, and that's in early stage resected tumors, by the way, but their vaccination, at least, and the induction of a response correlates them with maintenance of a tumor-free state. So, we've had for many years, thousands of vaccine trials in cancer, and in advanced cancer, they really haven't worked, unlike in the preventive setting. So in the end, maybe what we're coming to, as you've kind of just alluded to, is combination of cell therapies with vaccine therapies is very appealing.
Another big issue in the space, and one that you've really addressed, is is, and it really comes from accessibility questions on the ability to create CAR Ts at scale for everybody, is the development of in vivo CAR T delivery. And this is something that's really exciting. I know you're a co-founder of Capstan Therapeutics with an illustrious team there, Penn. But how do you see the entire field of in vivo CAR T developing? I know it's early days yet, but it's incredibly exciting.
This is just, I think, one of the best examples of how fast things can change. You know, a paradigm shift where 10 years ago, the field to a person, I think, said we would never be able to, you know, really give like an integrating virus in vivo.
Yeah.
And, you know, to do manufacturing in vivo. And now we have Saar Gill, one of our Parker co-directors here. His spin-out company, Antares, has just announced the first patient dosed with an anti-CD20 lentivirus, you know, to manufacture CAR T cells in situ. And Justin Mechim at the University of California has really made great progress using AAV-based vectors for in vivo delivery. And then there's been the whole lipid nanoparticle approach, which is what Capstan is going to test. So I think we're going to have both in vivo deliveries with either viral-based vectors or viral-like particles and lipid nanoparticle, as well as ex vivo manufacturing, have a firm space.
I think it is super exciting. I mean, this is a field that when you start to talk about your combinations, your ability to make, things that modulate the tumor microenvironment combined with multi-CAR approach, this is really an area that I'm tremendously excited about. The downside and one that Saar has to address, you guys have to address, Justin, everyone, is that the body's really built to see viruses and clear them. Like that's why you have an immune system. So it is a challenge to kind of overcome, but one that has such a huge upside that I can't wait to continue to dive into it. There's another area that I think hasn't got as much attention, but it was addressing the same issue, which is allogeneic CAR T therapy, which has been a bit more challenging over the field. How do you feel about that? At least in the cancer space, it's been tough. But you know, we'll see some advances in regenerative medicine and other fields for this. But how do you feel about that? And what do you think those challenges are?
Well, I think Great Ormond Street Hospital at UCL, you know, has been a leader in ex vivo, but allogeneic cell therapies. And they've used, you know, TALENs, they've used base editors. So in the laboratory, we can do that. And in some patients, you cannot, for various reasons, make autologous CAR T cells either in time or because of lymphodepletion and cytotoxic therapies. So they have a role there. But to date, the persistence of the cells has not been the same as an autologous cell expressing the same cargo. And that's, you know, likely due both to host T cell and natural killer cell and macrophage elimination of the infused allogeneic cells. And, you know, we have had an issue in the field, which is whether or not engineered T cells transform, the so-called CAR T cell lymphoma issues. With autologous cells, that's very rare. And mostly it's due to pre-existing clonal hematopoiesis in patients with autologous cells. But with the allo cells, if you are actually successful in manufacturing cells that can't be rejected by the host, you know, my concern is those cells then could be a reservoir where they could be infected by a lymphotropic herpes virus like EBV mm-hmm. or HHV6 and then turn into a lymphoma, you know, by the lymphotropic herpes virus. But then since the cell's already been engineered to escape immune recognition, I think that's a very dangerous, it's like so-called PTCLs.
Right, right.
And so I think we don't probably want, at least with an envisioned future, to have, you know, allogeneic cells persist indefinitely. I think they have a real role, you know, for transient administration, and yeah. particularly in this evolving area that you touched on, you know, autoimmune disease, you know, beyond cancer, where you may not need long-term persistence.
Yeah, that is really interesting. So this is a big area that we're thinking about now, and I think based on your own work and the work of others, the I don't want to say, so far it's been kind of repurposing of existing cancer therapies, but But how do you see that field evolving in the immunotherapy space, particularly for autoimmune disease, CAR T therapy? How do you see that moving? And, you know, in cancer, we have to be very selective, say, for the single target that we're going after, you know, CD19, you name it. But in the autoimmune disease space, because it's such, it's a fully dynamic response, you can go after targets that are, you know, subsets of T cells, subsets of B cells. How do you see that evolving in combination with sort of cell therapists like yourself and autoimmune disease experts?
Well, to me, it's been fascinating to watch this. I mean, a mouse results really for 50 years really said we had to really overcome autoreactive T cells in order to have, you know, induction of tolerance in most autoimmune diseases. And then, you know, in Germany, Georg Schett and Andreas Mackensen have done this series of patients now with three different autoimmune diseases that are systemic and using the same CAR basically that we've made for leukemia and lymphoma targeting CD19, they get, in most cases, complete responses in those patients. And so that now has been confirmed at other institutions, including our own.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And so that has been a paradigm shift. I think I did a search on clinicaltrials.gov recently for BCMA and/or CD19 CARs in autoimmunity, and there were over 80 trials listed that are ongoing now.
So it's, wow.
It is, you know, what we're going to find is an emerging landslide of clinical data.
Yeah, that's great.
Find out what needs to be targeted. And then it'll come down to, as you're getting to this Occam's razor of how much of the endogenous immune system do you have to really target in order to reestablish tolerance? Do you have to really, you know, do a tabula rasa and eradicate all B cells and long-lived plasma cells? Or can it be a subset of those cells? And, you know, and clearly in young children with autoimmune disease, you know, eradicating the entire immune system is going to be a larger immunodeficiency than if you, for instance, give a CD19 CAR in an older adult who has a long, you know, a lot of established memory plasma cells.
It's obvious. This is an enormous advance in a field that really needed advancement and needed attention. So it's absolutely huge. But it's, and so I don't want to make light of the progress that's been made recently, but very quickly, you want to try to get them off IVIG. You want to get them, we want this to be just a better and better therapy. And because it's just blue sky right now, we can really dive in. We can qualitatively modulate those CAR Ts and begin to ask fundamental questions. One of the most exciting things that you mentioned was you don't need the kind of persistence that we need with other types of, say, in the cancer space, that this concept of immune reset, I find very, really interesting, and I'm not sure I fully get it. But in autoimmune disease, you can sort of reset and at least get rid of some of these plasma blasts, and they seem to be responding very well to that therapy.
Yeah, we all thought that you had to do immunosuppression.
Yeah, of course.
And that was lifelong and it's both expensive and has side effects. And I think, you know, my own bias was that because of a lot of the, you know, MHC immunogenetics.
Yeah, sure.
There's an hereditary aspect to losing tolerance and getting pathogenic antibodies and autoreactive T cells. So the fact that this so-called transient reset of a B cell aplasia and or plasma cell, you know, aplasia is a, you know, calls into question that hypothesis.
I think
it must mean that without activated B cells, that these autoreactive T cells must very rapidly either reestablish tolerance or actually just die. We don't know yet the mechanism of what's happening, but, we're going to see very rapid progress and I think, you know, it's going to bring in issues of, you know, the ethics in where we've been talking about pancreatic cancer and glioblastoma of doing first in human trials is going to be quite different than in someone who has an autoimmune disease that's not curable, but it's not immediately lethal. I think it's going to be, it's in a way, it's been very good that I think the oncology field led with, you know, the demonstration that CAR T cells could work and
absolutely
launched that as a new biopharma. And then now I think we're going to see a variety of non-malignant diseases treated with engineered cells thanks to oncology.
Yeah, because the university medical centers and the pharma and biotech are all very comfortable with the modality now and physicians. So one question, I wonder if this is, you know, I'm always going to get back to cancer. You know, it's always going to steer back just. So as we dive into the autoimmune disease space, there are clearly different qualities of autoimmunity. You know, type 1 diabetes is fundamentally different than SLE and MS. Are there lessons as we begin to delve into this space with cell therapy that we can learn in overcoming tissue-specific, maybe even CD8-driven kind of autoimmune disease like type 1 diabetes or even T-cell-driven disease like MS, that we can learn from autoimmune disease that we can take back into cell therapy for cancer? You know, as we begin to look at this, I'm thinking MS space particularly.
This is, I mean, it points out really the shortcoming of many of the mouse models.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I have heard Jeff Bluestone say over the years how many times you can cure an NOD mouse of type 1 diabetes, but then how many times it's failed in human trials. So now I think the upside of this is that these experiments are going to be done in humans. And what I hope happens is that biopharma and academia collect samples so they can do the deep analysis so that we learn why sometimes it works, why sometimes it doesn't. And as you just implied, there's going to be many examples of cross-cutting, you know, learnings between, say, the cancer and autoimmune, you know, fields. So that's what we need to do is to enhance that learning so that people don't make mistakes twice, for instance.
Oh, yeah. Or three times. Yeah.
Because there will be unknown and unexpected toxicities.
For sure.
But we'll also learn like how to break, you know, tissue specific tolerance issues. Like I think that may be very useful for understanding
exactly,
you know, tumors and various organs.
On that same point, we talked a little bit about the in vivo CRISPR editing and humans. This again, I think, highlights the, you know, really the issues associated with the model systems we have out there. I'm not sure that, I know there's been huge advances in organoid culture, even multicellular organoid culture, and I'm, you know, really excited about that and moving forward with it. But do you think that we'll ever get to a point where at least some of the fundamental aspects of these cell therapies can be modeled in vivo prior to going to human, or is it the early stage clinical trials that are really going to be essential?
Well, I think we're getting better and better with organoids I've been impressed at Stanford what, you know, Calvin Kuo has done of Ross and Mark Davis with, for instance, tonsillar biopsies on, you know, from patients to study an immune response, even against COVID, you know, in tissues like that. And I think here at Penn, we have an ongoing trial, you know, led by Don O'Rourke in glioblastoma. And he's worked with Ho Jung Sun, who here has made a really useful organoids that are patient specific from the patients. And the early data on these patients is, you know, a patient with glioblastoma can have at the time of resection, neurosurgical resection, some of that can be used to establish an organoid. And then the patient can be treated with CAR T cells. And the initial data is that the CAR T cells then that we make from the peripheral blood of that same patient, so everything's autologous, their response seems to correlate with what we get in the organoid correlates with what happens in the patient.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So that, if that holds up, it's going to be huge. It means, I think, that we're going to need central, you know, repository ways to establish these, because there's going to be, you know, to get the numbers and power to make, we're going to be underpowered a lot of things, but this is where I think AI and machine learning could be huge by, because they're so complex in the cell populations and the organoids and why we respond or not, and then why in a biopsy it does or not. But so we'll have multidisciplinary and multi-omics, and we're going to be drowning in data on that, and probably in there will be answers on why some patients respond and some don't.
This is sort of a looking forward a little bit in space. What do you think are kind of the most exciting things that are coming out in the immunotherapy space moving forward? Next, what are your sort of hopes for the next 5-10 years as we move forward in the space?
Well, I think, you know, there's 6 FDA approvals in blood cancer. And each one of those cancers is maybe 30 or 40,000 patients. But when you add up all the blood cancers between, you know, myeloma, leukemias, lymphomas, it's about the third most common of all cancer, you know, after lung and breast cancer. So there's 6 FDA approvals there. The main area where the cell therapies haven't worked is AML. And for AML, other than maybe the IDH mutant forms, you know, the therapy is pretty much the same as when we were in medical school. And unless you can have an allotransplant, it's really a very poor outcome. So we definitely need to have advances in AML. And so there's some really exciting approaches on that that I think are will happen in the next year or two. The one that I'm working on with Sargil is base editing and a combined therapy with engineered stem cells and T cells to target the CD45 tyrosine phosphatase.
Nice.
But when you move out to solid cancers, I mean, we have had, you know, really, we've had, I think this year, if you're an optimist, the real highlights have been the fact that TIL therapy, you know, has finally gotten approval in metastatic melanoma and hopefully maybe even in lung cancer in the future.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Adaptimmune and getting approvals for sarcoma, a rare sarcoma with a TCR. So we have a long way to go. I think the optimism in solid tumors may be TCRs targeting KRAS.
Yeah.
And as you know, in the Parker arena, we have the work that Phil Greenberg's done at the Fred Hutch, Chris at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and then Jerry Lynette and Beatrice Carino at our institution are all working on various approaches to use T-cell receptors, you know, to target the oncogenic driver. And I think at least in the KPC mouse model of that tumor, that looks really promising. So
yeah, it's beautiful.
And then I think with CAR T cells and the editing approaches that we have, I think, you know, Kohlreuble has a number of variants in synthetic, you know, advances on SYN-Notch, which can allow the targeting of the multiplex targets that are required in most solid tumors. And at UCSF, you know, Wendell Lim and Hideo Kata have a trial using that technology in glioblastoma. So I'm optimistic we're going to chip away at the solid tumor problem over the next several years.
Carl, one of the things is whenever I'm on a call with you or talking, you travel a lot and you're out there, thankfully, evangelizing this incredible science that you've been pioneering.
Yeah, I mean, last week I received the Abarca Award in Spain, and that meant meeting with the King of Spain, and was an amazing experience. During that very day was when the flood in Valencia was happening, which was an awful thing we're still dealing with, you know, in Spain. I mean, climate change is hitting them just like it's hit us and in the eastern U.S. But then I was able to teach to the medical students something called a master class. And so that was a lecture followed by an extended, you know, question and answer, which was really a joy for me to be able to see how many people, this is in Spain, where they have a total different model of how they've distributed CAR T cells. The Spanish CAR T cell model is it's an academic model with the public partnership, and they their health authorities, their equivalent of the FDA there, has allowed that to happen. So it's different than in the U.S. where it's only with biopharma. So Spain has a very healthy way to rapidly check and make new CAR cells that I think we could learn from. And so that was a really great experience.
We talked a little bit before about access and, you know, being able to get that out there. This is, that's phenomenal. And then you won the Alpert Award as well, something that's fantastic alongside of, you mentioned some of the colleagues that you had in the field over the years. It's wonderful to receive an award, but also to receive an award with others.
Yeah, that award at Harvard was amazing. It was with Rainier Brenschens, Michelle Sadelain. And then Zelig Eshar was given the award, but he couldn't attend for health reasons. But his daughter was there, and we got to speak with her. And I have really great memories of going to the Weizmann Institute, you know, 20 years ago when Zelig Eshar, we reminisced about the name of CAR T cells. And Zelig called them T-bodies.
Sure.
So that's what he called them. And I wrote the first IND for CAR T cells, and I called it RAT 19.
Okay.
So, and RAT stand for redirected autologous T cells.
Sure.
Targeting C19. That was actually a bad name.
Yes.
I called it a RAT. And then Rainier Brenschens and, Michelle Sadelain called them in a review in 2003, named them chimeric antigen receptor cells. And fortunately, that name has been what stuck.
Sure. That's fantastic. This is such a great team and such amazing, illustrious colleagues. You also received the Breakthrough Prize last year, which is, I mean, this is a very high profile prize and obviously well deserved. So can you tell us a little bit more about that and the impact that that's made on the field and the sort of exposure?
So that prize was started as a, you know, to recognize American science, be called the American Nobel Prize. And it was, so it's held in LA with, a lot of the Hollywood celebrities come there. And it was an amazing event. And Michelle Sadelain and I, you know, shared that award, and it was really touching to see. And so it's been a very exciting time.
It sure has been. And I think these high profile prizes and just getting it out there on the news and getting people aware is always a good thing. How do you keep that work-life balance in real life? So what is it that your hobbies and focus that kind of keep you on the straight and narrow here?
You know, what's really different from when you and I started is now there's this very large biopharma. And, you know, so there's huge career opportunities and everyone has to decide, you know, what fits them best. And early on, there may be much more time required for, family and then later on, more senior time. There's more time and I devote more time now to mentorship now. But I still have time for hobbies like cycling, which I did this weekend.
Nice.
So, you know, it changes over time is what I tell people, and they need to work it out with their partner.
Yeah, this is it. I think having a support structure around you is critical for all of this. It's at least for me, I can tell you, it's been fundamental for sure. You know, one of the things that I always ask people on these calls is, if you weren't doing this, what else would you be doing? So if it wasn't that, was there another career path that you're interested in pursuing or that intrigued you that you would have pursued?
I was initially interested in chemistry, and in fact, my brother became a chemical engineer, and I think I would have done that. But I had a biology professor that really got me intrigued in biology.
Perfect. That's great.
And no one in my family had ever done medicine. And so I think people need to, you know, look broadly while they're in training, because mm-hmm. you just don't know. And then, but you also have to be prepared. I always say, we just had the last week, the conclusion of the World Series. And for me, that was a very interesting thing. It was the Dodgers and the Yankees. But the famous coach and former player of the Yankees had been Yogi Berra. And he always says, when you come to a fork in the road, take it.
Take it.
So just make a decision and do it and try it. And I think that's what I tell everyone. You got to take forks in the road because it's going to happen in your career. And then you find out what works for you and what, you know, you want to try something else or not.
When you're looking back, I think that you've seen the progress that you've made throughout your career. Can you tell me a little bit more about what kind of legacy you want to leave and the impact that you want to leave on the field of immunotherapy?
You know, for me, a legacy is having trained at this point in my career as many students and technicians, postdocs as I can, you know, to help accelerate the progress. I think we have this tremendous promise now, and now we need to realize it, as you mentioned, democratize it, But there may many basic science questions that remain to be answered. And now we need to have the new generation of students and postdocs to do that.
Yeah, getting out there and absolutely keeping that that legacy going. There's always more questions than there are people to address them. So yep. We just keep the training going. You've mentored so many fantastic scientists and clinicians out there, Carl. So what advice would you have for your next generation? Where should they be thinking about? What kind of approach and should they be looking at for their career paths moving forward?
Today is the best time ever to be going into research. The tools that we, when I started, you and I started, we had a lot of the same ideas of what the problems were, but we just didn't have the tools to engineer around those problems. And I think now the exciting thing for people entering the field, it's to learn synthetic biology. They need to learn bioinformatics, or be in a team that has that. I mean, because we're going to be in this world of, large data sets, that we never had to deal with before.
Yeah.
And then multiomics is really giving us the ability now to, I think, understand, why we succeed sometimes and others why we don't.
Yeah. And that application of kind of seamlessly integrating machine learning and AI into everything that you do. This is something I think grad students thankfully are adopting quickly, which is great because I think it's just a force amplifier. Well, Carl, I just want to wrap things up now, but if there's anything you wanted to add or any kind of advice that's out there, anything you wanted to highlight, just now's the time.
Yeah, I have at this point in my career, really want to say thanks to all the people that I've been able to work with because it was a team.
Absolutely.
Nothing happens by one person. And I have a great lab now, which is so much fun to watch them. Probably the best thing is every week when I have a lab meeting, I get to hear new results, and it's, you become the second person in the world to learn those things. And it's an exciting time.
It's incredible. Thank you, Carl. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate the time that you spend with us and the impact that you've made on the Parker Institute and the Parker Institute Network. And we'll continue to push the Penn Center and the entire network forward over the next 10 years alongside you.
I'm looking forward to it, John. It'll be a great journey.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to From Bench to Fireside from the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. And just heard Dr. Carl June explore how the PICE network is working to turn all cancers into curable diseases. Through collaboration across our network of world-class research centers, PICE is helping usher promising new therapies from lab discovery to patient impact. But the journey doesn't stop here. Your contributions power PICE's mission by accelerating the bold science that will transform cancer treatment as we know it. Make a donation to PICE and help bring cures within reach. Visit www.parkerici.org/donate. I'm Dr. Shane Corcoran. Join us next time on From Bench to Fireside.